GP contract has been updated, and in this episode, myself and Andy are going to go through the exact changes to the GP contract. So this is different to some of the stuff you may have seen from us before, because we're going through the actual GP contract and talking about what on earth is an assessment of need, is that the proper term, and how this is going to affect GP access for the coming year, and what this means for you, your practice, and your patients. Let's crack on and take enhance your primary care and learning. Hey GP learners, and welcome to this episode. Myself and Andy are going to be going through the GP contract and what this actually, well, the changes that have happened are actually going to mean, because they're coming into force in the next couple of weeks. Before we get started, how are we doing there, Andy?
Yeah, not too bad, Gandhi. Managed to rush home today so I can be with you from my own computer and own files and drive the screens in the background for the to help everyone have a good viewing experience. Yeah, another week, another crisis in general practice, another change. It's busy, isn't it, these days?
Definitely. As you can see, I'm still in practice doing this live stream, because I've not had the same opportunities as Andy to get home and stuff. But basically, in this episode, we are going to have a look at some of the actual changes to the GP contract. So this is this mythical document that many of you have heard about all the time and all that kind of stuff. We're actually going to look at the definitive contract itself, because last week there have been some actual changes made in law to the GP contract, and this determines some of the stuff that you've been hearing about for the past few weeks around the access, around capacity, and all that kind of stuff. We're going to basically cover those changes. Andy's done some really deep dive work into this, and we're going to start off by basically talking briefly about the GP contract itself, aren't we, Andy?
Yes. So if you hand me the screen, Gandhi, let's get started. So I guess, first of all, for those people who've had their head in the sand for the past month or so, we received a letter in March saying that the GP contract will be varied, that it will have an increased emphasis on access, and that there were headlines that sort of the GP surgeons will not be able to tell patients to call back on another day, that people will have to be given definitive care when they contact the practice. And they said that the GMS, PMS contracts will be varied to bring this into effect. And then there was a bit of a pause where we were waiting for quite a while to see what that would actually mean when it came through. People might have seen in the last few days, there's been headlines in Pulse, one of the friend of the podcast, and people have got quite concerned really about what these changes might mean and the effect they might have actually, not just on general practice, but on the wider system. And I guess we'll get to that when we discuss the impact later. So GPs must offer appropriate response to patients on the first contact, and then later people worrying actually about the effect that these changes might have on A&E, on walk-in centres, on 111 services. So what has happened? So on your screen you'll see the statutory instrument that has been used to vary the contract. This was sort of news to me, really, when I heard that the contract was being varied, because I was aware that the PCN DES, when that came into effect, there was a lot of talk about, actually, that this could be varied in the future to meet patient needs. And there was a lot of concern, at least locally to me, about whether, you know, whether we should sign that and whether that left us vulnerable. So I was sort of left with the impression that the main GMS and PMS contract was negotiated with the GPC, 5 yearly at the last one, you know, and that runs out next year. So it was sort of surprising to hear that might be varied. But apparently this sort of thing happens to public in the public sector quite a lot. So the GMS PMS contracts are actually part of legislation. So it all relates to the NHS Act, and then there's some secondary legislation, I believe. This is all a new area for me, and I guess, disclaimer, Gandhi and I are not lawyers. We are not politicians. Yeah, we're not civil servants. We're not commissioners. We're not your commissioners. So this is all, I mean, let's call it entertainment, I guess, for the purposes of today. But it's sort of discussion and entertainment. But anyway, if you sort of start to dig around on gov.uk website, you can find these original documents, actually. They're quite lengthy. I think I've looked at parts of it before when we've been deciding about how we operate as a practice, but I've never really dug into the whole document. So the statutory bills of parliament sort of regulate how the NHS functions and how GP practices function. Often major laws like bills in govern determined by bills passed through Parliament, contain provisions for them to be changed if the need arises or the circumstances arises. And this is done via a mechanism called a statutory instrument. And often, as isn't in the case here, the Secretary of State and the Department of Health have the power to use a statutory instrument to vary the content of the contract without that needing to go through another vote in Parliament. So hopefully I've fumbled my way through that explanation. Do you understand, Gandhi, at least, where I've explained that?
Basically, you've got the GP contract, that's set as it is, and then if they want to make a change, they use the mechanism called the statutory instrument, which is like an amendment to the contract. And although we thought that had to be, and it does state it has to be in agreement with the contracting party, which would be the GPC, there is actually a mechanism that allows them to make that change without consultation if they feel it necessary to do so. Is that correct, Andy?
Yes, that's right. Absolutely. There's also the primary medical care policy guidance manual, which I believe says that it ought to be in consultation with the GPC. But I guess if the need is sufficient, then they may do that without consulting the GPC. If anyone's out there and wants to correct us or provide some more context or information, please hop on the chat. So what we've got here is a statutory instrument. Now, the other thing, in order to understand the statutory instrument and what it is doing to the underlying contract, it's actually quite helpful to have a window with the statutory instrument open, and then also just open, and we'll link to this in the show notes, the main general medical services contracts, you know, the regulations that govern them. And then you can actually, and we won't do this live, but where it refers to a part of the regulations, which is 71ZA, which is one of the bits that's amended, you can do Control F in this window and you can go to that and you can find out what it used to say and what it's going to be replaced with. So that was something that I did while we were preparing for this this episode. And I'd encourage people to, you know, at least have a go. I think it's useful to be familiar with the, you know, the main contract that we are all following, delivering mm-hmm. services, particularly those of Azurian partnerships. So hopefully everybody is still with us and we can get onto what is in this statutory instrument and what is varied. And I think we'll move through the first few bits fairly quickly, because I think the access requirements are really what people are interested in at the moment. And we might digest some of the other things as we go through time, really. So let me reset my notes. We've done the disclaimer. We've explained what a statutory instrument is. So there was some talk about pay transparency and disclosure of pay. And this is covered by the statutory instrument. And this makes changes, which are actually a little piecemeal in terms of they're changing some words here and there. But the effect is to bring into force the pay transparency changes that we have talked about. Again, I don't think I will go into too much detail about that, but people can pick that apart or look at the coverage in the media that's already out there. Patient online services, this was another area that we were told would be varied in this statutory instrument, and it is indeed varied. Really, the changes act to just go through, really. So there's more of an emphasis on, whereas before we had to offer access to medical records, it's now replaced sort of offer and promote. So it's really more of an emphasis on promoting these facilities to patients, represented by the letter P here. And it also is clear about the date on which these changes come into place. Paula, she says you can hear you typing, Gandhi, so try and type more quietly.
I've stopped currently, so apologies on that.
That's good. So these changes come into place on the 31st of October. Gandhi, was there anything you wanted to say about that? I know we're kind of moving over these very quickly because we want to get to
I think this one just sets the tone for the fact that likely this October they are going to absolutely push forward with some of the online stuff in terms of that we're going to see, and particularly this is some of the preparation stuff in terms of patients being able to access online records, online booking, all that kind of stuff. So that's what a lot of this part is in reference to enforce that that's going to happen within the contract changes and stuff.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's this new date. So in the previous document there was references to 1st of October 2019 first mm-hmm. of all, and then the 1st of April 2020, and now it's the 31st of October 2023, and I think they do mean business this time with that. Let's move through to just scrolling through. I'm just wanting to find, yeah, so the telephone arrangements, again, this is something which we were told would be varied, mm-hmm. and indeed it is varied with the statutory instrument. And essentially the effect here is to insert another piece of information into the contract. Essentially, the contractor must ensure that any telephony solution adopted which serves the activities of the contract must meet the national specifications and standards framework. And so this is really about them being on that that framework of approved providers. So,
yeah. So just to clarify that point again, so this is the cloud-based telephony that many people may have seen and heard about, so that moving forward, all practices need to be using cloud-based telephony rather than hardwire landlines, ISDN lines, that kind of stuff. And this is in part because of the monitoring stuff as well. So what we're hearing is a lot of those platforms will be using data packages that allow the assessment for what's coming next, basically.
Yeah, good. So this is, and there's actually, it's not actually a long section, but this contact with the practice is the bit that I think everybody has been talking about, and that's the most controversial part of this statutory instrument. So this is the big bit. So this replaces, so this is a substitution. So paragraph 4 in Schedule 3, which dealt with contract for the, with the practice, has been essentially substituted and replaced with new wording. So what was there before? Was a question. So I had a look at the previous text of the contract, and this is the bit that stipulates the requirement for patients presenting to the practice in person without a scheduled appointment to be provided with appropriate care within that surgery period, so whilst the practice was open, unless one of the following things applied, which was it was more appropriate for them to be referred or seen elsewhere. They were offered at that point an appropriate future appointment to meet their needs. And actually the wording did specify telephone or video as well, or face-to-face in surgery, or they were invited to use the online consultation system. And any of the above would not jeopardize their health. And there's been a lot of talk actually, I think, about that word jeopardize, I've seen. And that was the word used previously as well. So there may be some historic usage of that word, and that's I guess why it's still used in the new version. So it was really that provision about people presenting to the surgery and providing a duty of care to them, or providing them with another option of care. And then it's been replaced by new wording, essentially. So the first bit so it says this now applies to people not just presenting physically at the practice by attendance at the contractor's premises, but also by telephone, also through the practice online consultation system, or through any other available online system. So it's really any contact with the practice it's saying that this new provision applies to. And we must take steps to ensure that a patient who contacts the contractor via these routes, which is essentially all of those that I think I can think of at the moment, is provided with an appropriate response. So people talked a lot about this assessment of need term, which isn't actually anywhere in this document or the old document. Mm-hmm. I've done my keyword searches and can't find it anywhere and haven't seen it, but appropriate response is quite a key phrase here. So appropriate response in accordance with the following sub paragraphs. So the appropriate response is that the contractor must do one of these following things, which is invite the patient for an appointment, either to attend the contractor's practice premises or participate in a telephone or video consultation at a time which is appropriate and reasonable, having regard to all the circumstances. So I think that's quite interesting, isn't it? It's not just the patient's circumstances, but all the circumstances, mm-hmm. Which I think in some interpretations would allow for practice capacity to be part of that, whether a practice can deal with things safely in that way. I think, can appropriately and reasonably be part of that consideration. So, or B, so these are all linked with or. So it's not all of them, it's or. Okay. Or provide appropriate advice or care to the patient by another method, which I think is quite interesting. I think that does bring into play providing self-care advice, for example. So I think that's interesting. And by another method. So that's an interesting phrase. And I do wonder if that means actually someone presents by telephone, you can say you're going to send them some information by another method and do it that way. In some ways, this opens up a lot of questions, as we've seen, as people have discussed this in the media over the weekend and throughout today. So, or C, invite the patient to make use of or direct the patient towards appropriate services which are available to the patient, including services which the patient may access themselves. Okay, or so there's something else afterwards, which I think is really interesting as well, because actually that's saying actually signposting to other services is an appropriate response. That's my interpretation of it. And even those that they might otherwise self-refer to. So things like walk-in center, pharmacy, 111, these could be interpreted as being appropriate destinations to signpost people to after that first contact with the practice. So I think that's interesting. Or we can communicate with this patient to request further information. And again, I think that's interesting. So an appropriate response might be that we have received an online consultation query providing a certain amount of information, and actually our response on the same day is to request further information from that patient to enable us to make a more complete assessment. So we can communicate to request further information, or communicate as to when and how the patient will receive further information on services that may be provided to them, having regard to the urgency of their clinical needs and other relevant circumstances. So again, that's quite interesting as well. And I do wonder if that brings into play some of these waiting list type solutions that people have been throwing around, because provided you tell people how and when they will receive further information, that seems to be acceptable. So saying actually, we will contact you within X amount of days. We have assessed your need, and and our appropriate response is that we will contact you with X number of days to then tell you when we will see you or what the definitive response will be. Again, there's a lot of interpretation in all of this, Gandhi, but I do I do wonder if that can be interpreted as bringing that into play. Always says having regard to the urgency of their clinical needs and other relevant circumstances. So obviously it has to be safe and appropriate. And at the end, it talks about this word jeopardize. So three, the appropriate response must be provided. Okay. So this is saying when we must provide it. So it must be provided essentially on the day that it's made, within opening hours, or the next working day, is my interpretation. So if it is made outside core hours, during the following core hours, in any other circumstances, during the day on which the core hours fall. So at least that's very clear about when we need to provide the appropriate response. We were talking today in surgery, Gandhi, about, this may be tricky towards the end of the day, 6:29 and so forth. And also depends on the number of contacts that you have. I know when people have done more total triage style approaches at their practices, sometimes they can be left at closing time with 20 cases to, still to review or decide what to do with. So that can place people in difficult circumstances, although it doesn't within the statutory instrument talk about having unlimited, capacity. It sure doesn't talk about that. It just talks about dealing with things safely. And then the final part here is the appropriate response must not jeopardize the patient's health, be based on the clinical needs of the patient, and where appropriate, take into account the preferences of the patient. So I think those are all interesting statements, moving from last to first, really. So where appropriate, take into account of patient preferences. I think that's interesting. So it sounds like there might be some circumstances where other considerations, say the needs of other patients that need to be looked after, might trump patient preferences, for example. That's my interpretation. Based on the clinical needs of the patient, I think we would always endeavour to try and follow that and not jeopardise the patient's health. And I know there's been quite a lot of discussion about the implications of that statement flying around today, and a large part of that about what they actually mean by jeopardise and where that statement draws the level of risk, because you know, some people might say, well, that might apply to anyone who we've not been able to completely assess, and therefore that means if we cannot completely assess everybody and be absolutely sure that their health is ensured, it does that mean that those people that haven't been fully assessed, you know, will have to be told to contact the walk-in centre 111, the emergency department? You know, what does that mean for those services? You know, if we take that to the extreme, so interesting. And I guess we can start to pick that apart in a second, Gandhi. The next section describes the amendment to the PMS contract, and actually, it is the same as the changes to the first one. The changes are, as far as I can tell, pretty much identical and have the same intention and the same purpose and the same effect, I believe. So, interesting. We can start to talk about that a little bit and pick that apart. And I'm sure people will have sent through some questions and or statements as we've been going. But any responses, Gandhi? Any reactions?
So I guess there's a couple of things there, obviously, in terms of the whole concept of what is this kind of like assessment process. So like you said, it's not termed as an assessment of need, which is what actually a lot of the original literature seemed to suggest is what it would be called. It's just a contact with patients and how they look at it. And like you say, they've just expanded it to include that actually prior to, you know, April, it was just patients attending the practice had to have some sort of assessment to be managed based on their clinical need. Whereas now it's patients contacting the practice through face-to-face, telephone, online consultations and other online methods, which I believe is basically to incorporate the NHS app in its main entirety, although there may be some of the local variations happening elsewhere as well. And then obviously there's that outcome, which I think we'll probably talk about in a bit more detail. We have got, like you mentioned, quite a few questions, so probably worth capturing those first. Shall we go for that, if that's all right?
Yeah. You know, I just want to bring your attention to one more thing.
Go for it.
Can you just pop us up again, Gandhi?
Yeah, give me 2 seconds. There you go.
Because I just love this last statement. A full impact assessment has not been produced for this instrument, as no significant impact on the private, voluntary, or public sector is foreseen. I thought that was a really interesting statement because I think the impact could be quite significant.
Hold on a second, Andy. I've missed this one. So there has actually been no impact assessment on the contract changes.
Not a full one, Gandhi.
Don't see this having an impact on the private, voluntary, or public sector whatsoever.
Yeah, well, they haven't done a full impact assessment. They may have done a small or partial impact assessment. But I just thought that was really, really interesting, given the sorts of conversations that people are now having after interpreting it about the potential effect on 111 walk-in centres, emergency department, pharmacy services, because of you know, how people interpret this jeopardised health, you know, and how seriously they take that statement. So really interesting. But anyway, I'll hand back to you, Gandhi. Take us where you were going before I interjected.
Do you want to know how to use System 1 more effectively as a clinician? There are various different things you can look at, but there is only one course that can help you understand this and have all my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, and that's the System 1 course for clinicians. If you want to have a look at it, have a look bit.ly/TPPS1course, TPP and S1 in capitals. But if you do have a look at it, what will you get? Well, you'll get content and information and guides on how to use System 1 more effectively, from getting started with System 1 to navigating the patient record, to understanding the key parts like doing a consultation, as well as prescribing, clinical admin, communication, and various other information. And this includes my hints and tips on how to use System 1 so much more effectively, so it saves you time and your patients stress in terms of their navigation with their patient journey. If you want to have a look at it, check out the link. As I said, it's bit.ly/TPPS1course, and the TPP and S1 are all in capitals, and you will get access to all this content perfectly.
Even better yet, there's a money back guarantee. So if you don't actually find this course has helped save you some time, just let me know. I'll refund you the course once you've completed it and stuff. Catch you then.
Yeah, sorry, I'm just still reeling from that whole fact they haven't actually bothered to do a full impact assessment. That's bonkers to me. Anyway,
yeah,
we've had a few comments and questions. So Paula asked to clarify what is cloud-based telephony. And I think actually we've had an answer come from the group itself. So if I can bring up Creative Mind. So I think this means a switch to telephony systems based in the cloud, which moves us away from typical landline, allowing for practice to report on data points in relation to calls received and made. Any further comment, or he or she further comments about how this could be useful in terms of data quality and tackling unmet demand, which, you know, many in general practice will probably feel we're struggling with the current demand, let alone unmet demand. But actually, there's some really good information out there that shows that actually tackling the unmet side of things may have an impact further down the line in terms of what you need to deal with from urgent to chronic kind of health issues and stuff. But very much this is that shift over because of the infrastructure of telephony changing in the next couple of years, that actually we do need to move towards cloud-based systems, because actually the hardwire stuff that we currently use is no longer going to be functional from 2025, which is the main thrust for this changeover. Also adding in those data points that actually cloud-based telephony allows. And actually it kind of makes sense because it allows you to expand and potentially work more effectively, especially remotely, because all you now need is an internet connection, not necessarily a hardwire connection, which has often been a challenge for particularly many remote workers and that kind of stuff, isn't it, Andy?
It is, yeah. You know, and to be honest, I think cloud telephony is great. We've got it. We have a board behind our in our reception area in the admin office that shows, you know, how long people have been waiting, how many people are waiting on the lines. You can look at the average wait for a call to be answered. You can even do things like, you know, if somebody says, "Oh, I tried to contact the practice at this time and I wasn't able to get, you know, I was on hold for this period of time," that often forms part of complaints. You can actually see if that was real, you know, and go, and sometimes it is, sometimes it's not, you know. Mm-hmm. So it's really quite powerful from understanding what's happening in your practice perspective.
Absolutely. And if people want to know more about cloud-based telephony, I'll be covering some of that with several of the providers over the coming weeks and months as they're working up towards understanding some of these changes. It is very much driven by selecting particular providers. The NHS England side of things is very clear that you can only go to particular providers. So if you're not on one of those providers currently, you will have to change at some point when your contract is due for renewal. So that's a really important point for practices out there to be aware of. This is a change that you may have to make depending on who your current provider is. We do, however, have some more questions. So I'm still unclear on Imran Mir's question. So how does this link to SFE? And I asked him to clarify what is SFE. And he says statement of financial entitlement. Andy, any ideas what that is?
I'm not sure I have an answer for that, I'm afraid.
I'm not sure.
I think that might relate to some of the changes about statements of earning, potentially. If you want to phrase the question in a different way, we might be able to provide an opinion, but I'm not quite sure about that, I'm afraid.
Okay. And then I guess some of the following comments and changes are more about the specifics about what this means from a perspective of how you assess patients. So I guess at that point, we're going to kind of go on to our reflections of the actual kind of contract changes and stuff, and give you, I guess, some of the opinions we have, and also feed you into some of the additional resources that you can access as well that may help understanding some of this. Where did you want to start, Andy?
So I think I'll start by what isn't in the statutory instrument, I think, because so the phrase assessment of need isn't in there, but we talk about things like contact with the practice and appropriate response. That seems to be what it's based around, defining contacts with the practice and defining what and how an appropriate response is and should be delivered. So that's the language it talks about. There is no mention of 2 weeks anywhere, just in case anyone was under any illusions that there would be, or that there is, not in the original document that's been amended, nor in the amendments, which I thought was interesting. Anything else that wasn't there? Yeah. So just interesting that those aren't there, given that they were in some of the government announcements.
So I guess just to pick up on that, that's not there in the contract changes. However, it is in the stuff around the capacity and improvement plans that networks and practices are looking at. So I think that's the key distinction. The two-week thing that did kick up a lot of commentary a few weeks back is not in the contract. It's around the PCN DES. And I know many people have been confused around the two different aspects, because they're both released at the same time and they're both linked so inextricably because of the funding, that actually it's important to delineate the two different things. The two-week thing relates to the PCN DES, which is the IAF side of things, so the capacity and improvement plans that practice and networks are doing. It's not relating to the contract, which is the stuff you have to do, unless you want to be in breach of your contract.
Exactly. It's the consequences of not meeting the requirements are very different for IAF compared to core contract. Mm-hmm. If you don't want to be in breach, if you don't have your contract taken away or be sort of managed to be in breach of your contract. So that was interesting. I thought actually, in a way, if you separate this from the previous letter and the discussions mm-hmm. of the previous letter, and this might be, I might be suffering the effect of friend of EGP Learning Overton's window here, which is that concept where if you want to shift what is considered reasonable debate around an issue, you say something that is way outside of what is reasonable, and then the window of what's reasonable shifts a little bit towards that. So yeah. It might be that what they said the changes were going to be just opened up that window of what we would find acceptable, because actually, given what was said before, looking at these changes, you could squint and say actually it's providing a bit of clarity where there wasn't clarity. It's actually saying that, or appears to say, in my interpretation, that actually we can, when we cannot deal with people in a way that does not jeopardize their health, signpost away from the practice to other services, including those that they might self-refer to, which I believe would include 111 and would include walk-in centres and all those kind of services. So actually, in a way, we might welcome some clarity, around that in terms of managing overwhelming demand. So some of it could be positively received in some ways. So that's just an interesting thought that was left with me. Yeah. Did you have any initial thoughts or reflections?
I guess the original thing that I remember hearing was that one of the rumours or one of the commentary going around this is that the direction to other services like 111 and A&E was not going to be an option for practices. So the suggestion was that would not be an option. Now it is. And quite appropriately, it should be, because there are definitely going to be cases where referring the patient back to 111 is absolutely appropriate. There are absolutely going to be cases where a patient contacting a GP practice should be told to go to A&E, and they've unfortunately just fallen foul of not being aware of how significant their symptoms are. So, not to have that option, I think, would be a significant clinical risk that no government would ever want to take, regardless of what their view is on, how patients access healthcare and stuff. So I think, the fact that we do have those options is really important for practices. And I think understanding how best to use those options needs to be clarified by many practice teams, because I think what the government's trying to suggest here is that we don't want everybody going to 111 and we don't want everybody going to A&E, quite clearly, because that's not going to work. It's going to break the system. To be honest, often directing patients to 111, we know, ends up just coming back into the practice through other routes, like the CCAS route and all those other kind of things. And it makes mention in some of the other stuff we're going to talk about the directory of service stuff that if you haven't heard about, you definitely need to know about and things. But I think, the key thing that in some ways I like about this, like you said, Andy, it clarifies what practices can do. It comes down to the interpretation then of what those actions mean on an individual patient basis, that gets a little bit more sticky, shall we say.
It does. And I guess you can't, provide wording in the contract for all circumstances. So there's always going to be some interpretation that's needed. The other thing I thought was interesting is that it sort of brings into place some of the waiting mechanisms potentially that people have talked about for a while, and actually potentially puts provision for them there within the contract, which I think is interesting, which is, it's this section, communicate. One of the responses can be to communicate with the patient as to when and how the patient will receive further information on the services that may be provided to them, mm-hmm. in regard to the urgency of their clinical needs and the relevant circumstances. So, I imagine that can be used to say, actually, for non-urgent issues, the best management of the patient's care and practice resources may be to say, actually, we will not book an appointment right now, but we will get back to you, you know, with an appointment, when we are able to schedule that, essentially. Which, I mean, you've still got the same demand to manage, I guess, but it just gives you a little bit of time to be maybe cleverer, smarter, you know, think about how you're going to, you know, where that's going to end up. Because I think all too often, non-urgent issues can end up in a slot that would be better used for an urgent issue. Often, you know, when there's a scramble for appointments through reception, 8:30 in the morning and so forth. So it sounds like we might be able to be a bit smarter about how we use that, and that might benefit patients and practices potentially. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was an interesting part of the contract.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think this tries to tackle that whole concept of people having to, you know, the 8 a.m. dash for getting into the appointment slots and not being able to, and not passing over some of that kind of awareness or clinical responsibility that a patient has an issue to the practice, and then it gives it to the practice to manage that element of risk or that element of how do we manage this particular patient. And now that answer can clearly be, actually, this is not medically urgent, you need to go to 111, you need to go to the pharmacy, you need to go somewhere else, self-care, for example. It could be that actually we do need to deal with this, but we don't need to deal with this today or in the imminent future, so we're going to put you on a waiting list to be dealt with when we've got the capacity to do so, and that may be later on this week, that may be next week, and etc. Or it could be that this is actually something we do need to see today, and here are your options of how we can deal with that. Either we need more information to better understand how we need to do that, so that's that additional information part. Or it could be that actually this needs to go to something like CPCS, this needs to go to A&E, this needs to come into us to be seen and stuff. So there are those various different routes, and there are probably a few extra that people will come up with, and happy to talk about those. But effectively, it's solidifying that whole process so that there's less, and I think this is what the aim of this is, to have less of that patient rings up every single day and the practice is not aware of their health issues, and therefore they're left without knowing what to do from the patient's perspective, and it's building that health anxiety. And I think in some ways this may help with that. What this contract doesn't in any way, shape or form do, though, is deal with the fact there just isn't enough bums on seats to deal with all of that in this way. So then practices will need to come up with ways to try and make this manageable or be in breach of their contract, which is the worst case scenario in this situation.
Absolutely. The other thing as well that I think it brings into play is this section about provide appropriate advice or care to the patient by another method, which mm-hmm. I think is interesting. So I can see potentially patients who contact the practice with a query about, I'm otherwise healthy, I've had a cough for 2 days, they've gone through an online consultation that allows you to establish with a reasonable level of certainty that they are not, their health is not jeopardized, that actually maybe they can receive some self-care information, via email or text message or something like that, perhaps with some safety netting that then tells them about how they can self-refer to other places if they need to. And that might allow us to discharge care to some patients more quickly and actually feel that we are covered by the contract, which says that sort of thing is acceptable. That's now part of the contract. So I think it's interesting and could be viewed as not entirely negative. People are going to come after me now for general practice. Although, this sort of not jeopardize their health and the effect on other services where practices find it difficult to implement, I think, is a big issue. Because I guess, as you say, Gandhi, it doesn't produce those missing GPs or AMPs or practice nurses, which really we need to be there to meet patient needs. The reason that practices aren't meeting patients' needs before the 15th of May or not perceived to is not because nobody thought to make these changes to the contract, and actually after these changes have been made, that doesn't resolve those workforce issues straight away. So People just have to be realistic. And where it generates a lot of pressure on a system that really can't deliver to have to try and deliver something safely, I can see in those areas, actually, a lot of people using the contract to protect the safety of patients and to protect the integrity of services, and people might bounce off to other areas of the system. But I guess that'll just further highlight problems with the system. And
sure.
Maybe.
So I guess to go through some of the questions that we've had and things. So Anna's asked one, which you've already answered, Andy. So is there a specific date when we have to commence this? And also any idea how it'll be monitored, patient feedback or use of cloud-based telephony? So I guess to answer that first part. So this comes into force on the 15th of May. So it's just over 2 weeks from the time of us filming this particular episode and stuff. And therefore, as a result of that, that's when it starts. This is 3 days after practices submit their improvement and capacity plan that we are doing from the network perspective and things. Yeah. And just as a point out for many of those watching, myself and Andy are doing another stream with Tara and Ben from our PCM Plus, so obviously from their respective podcast, talking about some of that aspects. And this as well, you're going to get their opinions as well. And that's on this Saturday, 29th at 11 a.m., if you want to jump in and join us. Alternately, we will have that coming up either up here or at the end of this video for you to join in and watch and stuff if you want to. So that's going to be more detail and stuff, and particularly focus more on that improvement capacity report stuff. Anna also asked about how it's going to be monitored. So we don't know is the simple answer, because it's really hard for them to get the kind of metrics from this kind of data as to how it's doing. But we very much do think cloud-based telephony is going to form a big proportion of that in terms of the data analysis packages that come in terms of the number of patients dropping off and that kind of stuff. But the survey is kind of being used by proxy, isn't it, Andy?
But the survey results won't be published, you know, taking account of these changes for a very long time, probably about a year. I think we probably might see some secret shoppers. I think complaints provides a lot of soft intel for compliance with contracts. So and a lot of this soft intel systems are out there, and I think CQC sort of, you know, share and liaise with our commissioners within ICBs, ICSs and CCGs as well. So I suspect there probably will be some monitoring of these changes, or at least they have ways of knowing what's happening. And we had some patients ring up today, Gandhi, saying you have to offer me an appointment now, they said. And I mean, the first response to that was, well, the contract hasn't changed until the 15th of May, and we're still digesting what that means and how we're going to change the services, because we only found out about this last week. But that doesn't change anything now, right now, not today, was our response on the telephones today.
And again, important to recognise that the offer of an appointment is not necessarily the outcome that has to come. It's the offer of contact, which is slightly different.
An appropriate response.
Yes, an appropriate response is the actual term. So, you know, it does not mean that every patient that contacts a practice has to have a physical appointment with the practice when they want it. That's not what the contract says. It says there has to be an appropriate response. Appropriate, as ever, is based on perception.
Yeah, just because we were mentioning compliance and contract monitoring, probably worth saying, and I think we'll say this again at the end, I think probably other parts of the system in the ICS will also be, may feel a little wrong-footed by this, because it's come quite quickly for everybody. Mm-hmm. And they might be quite worried about the effect that this might have, and the way this is interpreted by general practice, the effect that will have on the rest of the system that they're responsible for. Walk-in centers and stuff. So actually, using your LMCs or your other apparatus locally to talk to the commissioners and actually work out how everybody is going to get through this together, I think is always going to be a constructive approach.
So we've got some more questions, and we'll cover those and then go into some tools that will hopefully help you understand how to tackle this yourselves. So Sarah or Raymond Stokes, so can we assess their need and advise them to call tomorrow to book a same day appointment? I find haggling a time when a patient can fit in to come and see us around the commitments challenging. So technically, yes and no is probably the best way of describing that one. So you can't tell them to call back tomorrow to book another appointment. What you can, however, do is say that I can offer you an appointment potentially tomorrow, and here's the route for you being able to book it, for example, through a self-book link that the patient could choose to use. That's one option. But from my understanding, you can't tell them they have to call back tomorrow to go through the whole process again. That's the key part.
Yeah, so not one of the responses that is named as part of the appropriate response. So it's not it's not mentioned specifically that you can't do it within the contract, but it's not one of the options that you have. And I think there's an emphasis actually on the practice, taking the initiative on making sure that the next step happens. My interpretation is that you probably can't do that. You need to find another way, even if that way is to say you might have an urgent problem. You know, you may want to, you know, one of the places you can get help is 111, but you just can't say the call back tomorrow. As I can imagine my receptionist saying, what I cannot tell you is that appointments will be available again tomorrow morning, and I cannot tell you that an option you have is to call back. I'm not quite sure how that lands. I'm not quite sure whether that'll actually happen at my practice, but it's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Next up, we've got comment from Maria. We run a non-urgent online email query system. People seem happy with the response 2 to 3 days later. What is your interpretation of this sort of contact? Will we have to abandon it? So again, Andy and I are not lawyers on this point, and we are by no means contract negotiators either. However, I would say that as long as you've got some sort of feedback mechanism to the patient to state that this will be kept on a, you may just need to change the wording, you know, this is on a waiting list and we will contact you in the next 2 to 3 days as you would anticipate care and something along those lines. That's what I'm kind of thinking, Andy.
Yeah, I mean, I think, so this is about complying with, you could comply with section D2. So as long as you tell them as part on the same day that they contact you, just this bit here, as long as you can communicate with them as to when and how they will receive information on the service that may be provided to them. So as long as on the same day, you're saying actually we will contact you within 3 days to tell you, you know, the outcome of this. And if you get worse, then these are your options. It feels like that would be compliant to me. As a non-lawyer, non-commissioner, etc.
Definitely. So Janine Beatty is saying IFACC08, which is the one that talks about the improvement capacity report and the 2 weeks and stuff. We don't have any details yet. True, they haven't specified exactly what the 2 week stuff is, but I think it's very much linked within the improvement plans. So we've been looking at our plan, and it's included in that side of things. So I wonder if they're partly waiting for this to all come through the wash anyway and stuff, but hey. Imran's commented about the SFE being about the payment conditions for the GMS and also for PMS. I'm afraid I'm going to have to feign some elements of...
I think we at least understand the question better now, but I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah. I'm afraid. Next up, we've got Doug Alf. Will practices then push their patients to online access models to find this contract easier to manage? I think potentially, if you've got a predominantly face-to-face method of dealing with things in practice, you may find some of the waiting list side of things and you know how to manage that unmet demand a bit more challenging if you aren't using various other routes. Also, additional important to remember that the contract was adjusted to, the IF part was adjusted to state that patients should have equality of access no matter what route they use. So you can't tell patients they have to come down face-to-face for all contacts, just like you can't tell patients they all have to have online contact only. There has to be a suite of options offered by the practice. So it's important to remember that you do need variety.
Yeah, you need to offer different modalities, and that's actually really defined. Section 4.1, contact with the practice, it says how they can contact the practice. It includes all of those that you've mentioned, Gandhi. I think it would make it easier to manage. So I know we've been talking about how we're going to implement this as a practice. And in some ways, it's actually become quite an interesting conversation. And I think we probably will emerge with a better way of managing patients, or at least a more robust way. The patient experience for many patients might not be as good as it is now. But then I guess there's a lot of people who are bouncing off at the moment that we kind of have to capture their need and process. I think the whole thing is easier to manage and monitor with the online systems. So I think a lot of people will move towards that, where a patient's sort of capable and able to use that system. I think we'll be sending them much more in that way, because that allows that initial capture of information to be automated, and then it can be dealt with asynchronously by a supervision admin person or by an on-call clinician. So it just feels like that's going to be one of the easier ways to manage this, I think.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a few more extra questions coming in, and I think I'm going to go jump to this one because it brings in some of the extra stuff, and then we're going to come to the final ones from there. So the first one is, any news about a BMA response? So there hasn't been, as far as I can see, a definitive BMA response to this part. However, there have been some supportive pieces of information, which Andy's going to bring up on the screen right now, and we're going to show you. So there has been this concept of care and navigation and triage in the general practice published by the BMA, which was actually came out a couple of days before the contract was amendments were brought through, and gives some guidance about how to do more specifically care navigation and triage within your practice. And it's actually reasonably good information. There's flow charts, there's case examples, and particularly case examples with different platforms. I think they picked two of the predominantly larger online consultation platforms, so eConsult and Accurix. And they're showing you how you could make this potentially workable in your practice. So I think there is some supportive information there, but in terms of an actual response from the BMA, apart from condemnation of enforcing a contract and all that kind of stuff, I've not seen any other changes at this point in time, and happy to be corrected on that point. Your thoughts, Andy?
Yeah, I think this sort of thing's really helpful. Obviously, this was done before we knew the letter and the law of the changes. So I'd hope to see some more stuff come out. But again, when we were having our conversations in practice, we found this really, really helpful, because all practices are now being asked. There's a lot more stipulation about what all practices should do. So we'll probably be seeing practices begin to do things that look a lot more similar. There's an awful lot of variety. Mm-hmm. At the moment, in terms of how people access their practice. So we actually found it. We do something very similar at the moment, but something coming from an organisation like the BMA that we can use, or adapt to our own needs, knowing that the original document came from a reputable source, is really, really helpful when we have to sell this and defend it to patients or local contracting teams and things like that. So I think it's really, really helpful. I'd be interested to see what comes out in the next few days and weeks, really, as we come up to the 15th, which isn't that far away.
And I guess just to make reference to some additional supportive tools, although we can't demonstrate it for you right here, but the one I would highly recommend many people have a look at is there's a letter brought out by the BBO LMCs, that's Bucks, Berkshire and Oxfordshire LMC. I may have got the B's the wrong way around. And if you want to get a hold of that document, I think you do have to be part of the LMC directly to have it sent to you. But I think there are other ways you can get a hold of it, particularly some of the groups and stuff have it. It's an excellent document that's similar to what we've done, sets out some of the stuff in terms of the different wordings and then the potential actions and outcomes you can have. We've covered all those in this actual session, predominantly, I think. We've got all of them. But it's a nice little tidy document that basically shows you some of the stuff you could do as a result of trying to make sure that you're compliant with the contract and stuff. I know Andy's not had a chance to read it, but I think it is good. And we will try and put a copy of that. It's just unfortunate we don't have a public access link to that we can share to you in the show notes. But all the other documents that we've shared with you, they are available in the show notes for the YouTube video of this particular thing, as well as on the podcast. So if you want to access those documents, do feel free to do so, because the links will be there and things. Any thoughts on that, Andy?
No, very interested to see the content of that. That sounds really, really useful. Just picking up another question, which I think is interesting. So Anna Brown has asked, does the contract mention that the patient should have a clinician-based assessment, e.g. if the trained care navigator, reception book or direct PCM physio? I assume that would be appropriate. So is it appropriate for the reception to book directly? And I guess just going back to what it says the appropriate response, which is the defined response, must, and then it says when you must provide it, same day, next day, if they've contacted you out of hours. And it must not jeopardize the patient's health. It must be based on the clinical needs of the patient. So they do use the word clinical there, but they don't say that assessment needs to be made by a clinician. And I think somebody following a decision tool, my interpretation is that would be acceptable. And then where appropriate, take account of the patient's preferences. So those are the stipulations that are within the contract. So I think care navigation, I think, would be within the letter and also the spirit of these changes, I would suggest.
It should be, because that's basically using the tools within the practice to navigate patients to the appropriate clinical response. And, you know, part of that journey will be by non-clinical teams, because that's where the data capture side of things sometimes comes into play. Some of that will be through clinical parts of the teams. And, you know, as you mentioned, Andy, there's no specification that states it has to be a clinician that does all this work. And I think that's a really important practice to take hold of that. It does not have to be a clinician that does all of this stuff. Absolutely, you need a clinician to do some of it, because, well, it's clinical contact, isn't it, Andy?
It is. And it also doesn't stipulate kind of how many patient contacts you know, is safe, you know, should be done a day. It doesn't say that you have to accept an unlimited number of patient queries with the expectation that those will be dealt with, because I think stipulating that would put many people in an unsafe position. So that's not there. So, mm-hmm. So that's interesting as well. I think people need to just make sure they're practicing safely. And I think discussion, you know, open discussions with local commissioners on these issues are helpful.
Mm-hmm. So people have asked to see some of the documents. So I'm going to try and share the books BMOC directly with you. Bear with me, everybody. There we go. Thank you, Andy. So this is the overall document, 2023 requirements. It does similar to what we've done. It outlines the key part of the contract that you can see here. It then breaks it down into the different clauses, and it's got an interpretation with the BBO LMC on the right hand side. As I mentioned, pretty much every part of this myself and Andy have already covered. And then in addition to that, it comes to a summary, and I think probably worth reading this part out. So practice must take steps to ensure that appropriate response is sent to any patient makes contact. And this response must be sent same day and next day if the communication received outside of core hours. If the practice lacks the capacity to accommodate patient request the same day clinical safety permit, they may book a patient consultation in the future. So that's that waiting list concept. And there's no time frame that's been mandated, or indeed defer even the booking for a later date. So that's still an option. If it feels unsafe to manage to defer the consultation, or if there's other things, then that's when you can direct to other places like 111, A&E, CPCS, that kind of stuff. And that it can, I think the key point of this particular paragraph is that it does state that practices can defer to an alternative service provider. And then it reminds about the safe working limits. So I know Andy mentioned that briefly, that actually the contract doesn't state that you have to do unlimited workload, but actually practices can set their own safe working limits that they feel is in line with other kind of guidance. And there is guidance from the BMA and the GPC on what a safe working limit is. So I believe 25 consultations per day is often the number that's characterized, and that can mean different things in different practices because of your systems. I mentioned this earlier about the D directory of service data is accurate and reflects the ability to handle incoming demand from other services. So this is the stuff that allows other places to book into your appointments, particularly the CCAS stuff and that kind of stuff. If you're at a situation where you can't handle that extra demand, then you need to be changing that, and that needs to be done on a daily basis. And then they offer their assistance if you've got any further questions and stuff. Quite clearly, that is for BBO LMC practices. That's not going to be for everybody across the whole country, but I would hope that the GPC, BMA create a similar document and stuff that practices can potentially look at. If not, just watch this again, because we kind of covered it all for you. But yeah, so I know that's the first time you've seen that, Andy, as well. Any immediate reactions?
It looks like really good guidance. I often think maybe we need a lawyer on the EGP learning team to help us sometimes with some of these documents and the summaries. The overall anxiety I have with this Gandhi is that we're still not going to be able to meet the demand that's out there. We're going to just have greater knowledge of the demand, or know about the demand, if we're not careful. And we may end up sitting on lists, because I think this kind of list concept of can't deal with this demand today, but it's not urgent, we'll get back to in the future. I just worry that if you don't design your processes really well, you could be left sitting on an ever-growing list of people that you need to see or get back to. You know, previous total triage systems have sort of been based around this: do the day's work today, don't carry stuff forwards. And this permits that kind of carrying forward of lists of things to do, which we're not used to. So I think we need to just be very careful how we design our systems so that we don't end up carrying huge waiting lists and then like secondary care does, because I don't think that's going to work very well.
I don't think it's going to work in primary care, because the patient can just come back to us the following day. and say that actually
this can you write a letter to my GP yeah. to try and expedite my appointment with the GP? That'll be an interesting experience.
Actually, I've had a consultation similar to that just today, Andy. So there you go. I think, thank you. So we've got over 50 people joining us live watching this. So if you have found this useful, please leave us a like and stuff. We've still got some more comments and questions to go through. So we're not going away just yet, but would really appreciate if you could leave, like, comment, share this with people within your teams, because actually this is hopefully going to help direct to some of the conversation that's going on around this area. And we're keen to try and support as many people as possible. And as we mentioned earlier, we do have another session where we're going to be joined by Ben and Tara this Saturday, where you're welcome to join us. We're going to go even potentially deeper into this kind of stuff and feed into wider stuff. There are a couple of really important questions that have been asked that I think we need to cover, Andy, because I think it's relevant to what's going to happen.
Yeah, fire away.
So the one that in particular, here we are. So from Dr. Rajesh Raha, I believe the first time I've seen Rajashi, make a comment. Maybe I'm asking something stupid, but I hear this threat about breach of contract many times. What if we do breach the contract in this instance? What are you thinking there, Andy?
Not been in this position before, but I think there's something called the contract team with your local ICB, ICS, CCG. Who then come and have a conversation with you. I guess it depends on the severity of the breach and what you've done to sort of be on that naughty step, really. Mm. And I would hope that they begin with a constructive conversation about what's happened, although I guess it depends on the severity. I guess ultimately they can remove your contract. They may have the power to withhold payment. I'm not entirely sure, but I think they do have fairly wide-reaching powers that could have quite big implications on your business, your practice. If you breach contracts, it's not something to be done lightly. I guess another question is, what happens if everyone breaches their contract, in an area? Because I think that's a very different situation for the contracting teams. Maybe ask your contracting team how they would handle things if you were to not deliver on this part of the contract. See what they say. Better still, ask as a group of practices and ask, what if we all didn't deliver on this? What would you do?
I guess this may be something for your, LMC to ask directly, because I think there may be variations based locally as well. I think, as Andy mentioned, however, if you were going to ask this question, I would highly recommend asking this question as a group of practices, potentially a PCN or a group of PCNs or a federation as to what happens if these contracts are breached and stuff. We haven't got this question come through, but I think it's probably relevant to that federation perspective. This contract outlines the changes for GMS and PMS, but actually it doesn't recommend any changes about APMS contracts.
Oh, that was in my notes, but we skipped
over. I know, I stole it from you.
Oh, you stole it from my notes. Oh, okay, yeah. So, yeah, it's interesting. I don't know quite how that contract, can be varied. I bet there's some provision for the local teams to vary it or something, but it's not included in this document, which is interesting. I don't know the answer, but that had struck me when I was reading this before. Maybe someone out there knows the answer. I don't.
Potentially. I saw the question elsewhere. Where was it going? So Imran Mir again. How does anyone prove the breach of contract? We think this is a really challenging thing for local area teams to do. I think the only way that's going to happen is potentially by things like secret shoppers or potentially some of that data extraction that will happen from cloud-based telephony in terms of if you've got practices that have significant numbers of patients waiting, dropping off, for example, that kind of stuff, that may raise an eyebrow in terms of contract teams wanting to have a look at a practice. But I think also it's a really challenging thing to prove definitively that there's been breaches of contract in this sense and stuff.
Yeah, pattern of complaints, things like that, I think. I think more classic variations like, oh, there wasn't a GP in the surgery, on that day. More kind of matters of fact in terms of breaches of contract are easier to prove than matters where phrases within the contract are interpreted, like, did this reasonably jeopardize, someone's health? Was this response based on the clinical needs of the patient? Was it appropriate to take the patient's preferences into account? It's all open for discussion either way, isn't it? So I think it's difficult. And I think it's any kind of sustained digressions against the contract, in similar ways that maybe they can prove it. Not sure. If there's anyone from the contracting team out there, I'd be really interested to hear the answer.
potentially a live stream episode for us if somebody does want to jump in and join us and school us on the whole concept of contracting from the contracting team's perspective.
Yeah.
Definitely. Jen Littlest Hobo asked, can you drop a link to those flowcharts, please? It's already in the YouTube version of this. And if you're listening on the podcast, it will be there once we've uploaded the podcast, because it's going to come after this point and stuff. So do have a look there. There is the links to the BMA version of the safe working of the care navigation stuff. The BBO LMC one, like I said, that one's a little bit tricky because I know we've had someone else ask us to put that up, because actually it is through secure server access. There are places where it is available on social media, and unfortunately a lot of those places are in walled gardens that I can't share to. However, you could potentially contact the BBO LMC through their Twitter channel, and they may be happy to share that and stuff in terms of their guidance. But obviously important to recommend that that would be guidance for their LMC. It may be better contacting your own LMC for any specific guidance for your local area. Cook, I've got a few last quick minute questions coming through. So Riaz Galab, is there any guidance on safe number of contacts per day? Do we go to the BMA guidance for this? Yeah, simply put, that's probably the best place to go. The BMA does have guidance on safe working numbers and stuff. And actually in local areas, you may be having elements of that. I know in Nottingham, we've actually got a roadshow on this provided by our LMC in 2 days' time, actually. Yeah. Definitely worthwhile contacting them. And then how can a secret shopper get through system to find out how they respond if they're not registered? I've actually asked this question before, and I think the way that they get around this is by actually having registered patients be the secret shopper. So they approach patients to be secret shoppers and ask them which practices they're registered at, and then go from that perspective. But I must admit, I don't know, because technically that would be a bit of a weird thing to register with the practice to act as a secret shop, unless you did it as a temporary residence and stuff, which again, I think
they would have to work with organisations like Health Watch, for example. And I might be actually stretching the realities of my memory to say that that's happened in the past, but I've got a sneaky suspicion that sort of thing has been done in the past using Health Watch and some kind of, you know, tame patients to help them get that information. Because you're right, they might have some fake patients that they have the power to register, but I think people would pretty soon know who they were potentially, and that would cause all sorts of problems on the system, surely. So they must use real patients. Good question.
Definitely a good question. So thank you everybody for your time. If you do want to check out more information, like I said, do have a look at the links down below for the show notes for those links to those particular documents, and absolutely join us this Saturday. If you're watching this live, or if you're catching up over the following week, where we're going to be, like I said, covering similar topics to this with Ben Gowland from the General Practice Podcast and Tara Humphreys from the Business of Healthcare Podcast, talking about basically all the contract changes we've seen over the past month or so, the improvement in capacity reports that many practices have to have in the next couple of weeks or so, and how all this is going to potentially be made manageable for you. So this is going to be a significant live stream that we're doing. Myself and Andy are probably going to have even more information coming out for you shortly. We've got some really cool episodes that we just released, stuff about European working aspects and things, stuff about the contract, the DARES, all that kind of stuff. It's still coming. So definitely, if you've not already subscribed to the channel, please do so you get informed of all of that. We have an upcoming playlist even that explains so much of the upcoming feeds that we've got. And we've got some really cool stuff. So we've got things from Accurates coming up, cloud-based telephony, automation, various other things around the contracts and stuff as well. And as always, we're here to help tech enhance your primary care and learning.
Gabby, I've got one more thing to say, I just want to just tell you, this can get really stressful with all of these contract changes and announcements and headlines. And I have at some points in the past few months found myself, you know, almost losing my mind over this stuff. So you know, they just have to sit back.
Probably especially when I'm messaging you saying, Andy, there's a new document out, we need to get on this.
So pressing the emergency podcast button. So I just encourage people look after your mental health and try not to lose your minds over all of this. You know, I think we're more networks than we ever have been as a profession. We face more challenges perhaps than we ever have been, but, you know, let's try and work together and get through it. But yeah, and let's take it down to your primary care and learning.
Definitely. If you want to join us on that episode on Saturday, have a look right here, because it's probably coming up right now. We'll catch you then. See you later.
Oh, hello there, EGP learner. I'm Dr. Gandalf, and I often get asked, what kind of resources do you have to try and help those using EMIS? Because you tend to do a lot more stuff for System 1. And often I've really struggled to answer that question, because let's be honest, I don't use EMIS on a regular basis. So therefore, trying to help EMIS users is a little bit more difficult for myself. And that really made me feel, well, not great. So I kind of did something to try and help all those EMIS users out there. I went and had a chat with one of my colleagues, Dr. Mike from GP on the Move, and him and I have created a course that you can use to help you use EMIS so much better. That's right, if you use EMIS but you want to use it so much better, so much quicker, and in such a way that means you go home sooner, then check out our EMIS for Clinicians course. It's an online course that takes you through all the tips and tricks that Dr. Mike knows to try and basically mean you can go home quicker. That'd be a cool thing, wouldn't it? And guess what? It's currently on offer. So if you want to take advantage of this introductory offer and get access to it now, look at the links down below and check it out. Additionally, if you're a practice, network, or wide area that wants more opportunity to use it, send me an email, egplearning@gmail.com. Let's see if we can help you out. And as I like to say, tech enhance your primary care and learning. Shall we get back to it? Oh, and if you wanted one for System 1 users, well, you know I've got you covered, haven't I? Check out the Learn System 1 for Clinicians course, bit.ly/TPP S1 course.